Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin using automatic recurring buys at swanbitcoin.com. I'm Brady, head of education at Swan, and every week we invite two Bitcoiners to join us for a discussion hosted by myself and variously joined by Swan founder Corey Clipston, sometimes co-founder Jan Pritzker, or creative director Jason Don, or aka Brecky von Bitcoin joins us. It's a unique format in the Bitcoin content space to pair up Bitcoiners who have never or are rarely seen or heard from together. It makes for some great discussions. We broadcast these live and then we publish the audio here on this podcast feed. We call these sessions Swan Signal Live. This week, we are joined by Dr. Adam Back, a cypherpunk legend who is cited in both the Bitcoin and Tor white papers and is co-founder and CEO of Blockstream, and Preston Pish, co-founder of the Investors Podcast Network and a Bitcoiner. Be sure to follow at Swan Bitcoin on Twitter so you can tune in live whenever you are able. We also broadcast on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. The links to all of those are in the show notes here. But if you can't do it live, you'll be able to catch all the Swan Signal conversations here on this podcast. I'm glad you found your way here. Hope you enjoy. All right, welcome to Swan Signal Live, a really exciting edition here. We are live at blocks 632,092 with Dr. Adam Back, co-founder and CEO of Blockstream, and Preston Pish, the co-founder of the Investors Podcast Network. Welcome, guys. Thanks so much for taking time to join us.
Sure. Good to be here.
Great to be here, guys.
All right. So I'd like to start, since we have very fortunate to have with us here a man who's really been around from the beginning, really since the ideas that became Bitcoin were being hashed out on forums like the Cypherpunk mailing list. So Dr. Back, can you place for us, like in the broader arc of Bitcoin's history, what it's like to see, you know, this incredibly improbable project that had been worked on for decades by you and others come to fruition and evolve into what it's become today, just 11 years on since Genesis, past the third halving, and obviously making an impact on the global scene?
There were a previous electronic cash system in the mid-90s by David Chaum, and he had a startup called DigiCash. And people were pretty excited about that at the time. Mm-hmm. But I think Bitcoin just, amped things up a whole other level or two. You know, the previous electronic cash systems were largely like stablecoins, right? They were just trying to achieve $1 that you could move electronically, maybe with a little bit more of a bearer feel and some privacy, sort of that kind of direction, right? Where Bitcoin introduces the whole asset class, the digital gold kind of concept. And there were discussions about that, you know, going back to late 90s, like 97, 98 onwards, where people were trying to think about how to do this. But there were sort of gaps in the design, so it didn't get implemented. So I think in some ways, Satoshi, whether or not he actually read those things, it's not clear, but managed to fill in the gap that, to my mind, was about how to deal with inflation in this environment. I think people were thinking about it in slightly the wrong way, or had a design that involved sort of partially human involvement, like human markets or human rate saying about how much work you'd have to do to get a coin in this time period. Or Nick Szabo had the idea of a collectible market where you just create as many stamps as you want and somebody would collect together. And if there were not many stamps in a period, you consider those to be rarer and therefore more valuable. And somebody's task would be to collect a sort of standard set of rarity of stamps. So like a stamp book that has a certain value because you've pieced together stamps of different rarity and that would be your coin. So it's kind of indirect, right? Bitcoin sort of simplified all that stuff and made it automatic And so pretty much fixed the difficulty and just let the market deal with the rest, right? You know?
Yeah.
So that was, when you see it after the fact, having, you know, being part of those discussions and kind of grappling with how on earth can we make this work? It looks simple, but it clearly wasn't, because we, you know, we never managed to find, like, the people involved, you know, Halfini and Wei Dai and Nick Szabo and other people didn't quite get that last piece put together. But they were thinking about mining. They were thinking about doing it decentralized. They had Byzantine generals, and even smart contracts were part of the discussion. So, of course, the final thing is, like, very exciting, because it brings all those things together, and it has a lot of interest for as an asset class now. And, you know, given its release in the midst of the 2008 financial crisis, and now, of course, we have a whole new type of crisis, which is thrusting Bitcoin into the limelight yet again. Bitcoin's kind of made for this environment. Yes. So pretty interested to see what's going to happen in the next period.
Yeah, it's I feel like it's got to be, you know, extra just impactful to see Bitcoin in this moment, since it was born in the financial crisis, right? And you've been watching this happen and working on it for 30 years. And then now we're, you know, witnessing the problems on a global stage that Bitcoin was designed to solve. Yeah, I mean, what are you feeling about watching Bitcoin right now? It must be a bit surreal, I would imagine.
Well, I mean, I think it's just a return to the excitement. So, you know, the people are pretty excited about DigiCash, but it was centralized in it, and it failed for that reason. Like, yeah. The company went out of business, and then you couldn't verify the coins you had because the database wasn't available anymore. So, but the, you know, the level of interest globally, and I think, you know, you could see that the previous electronic cash systems were solving one problem, which is sort of privacy and transactability and bearer properties. And Bitcoin brings another dimension to it, which is a kind of financial asset. And so Bitcoin has a lot of interesting properties, and people get involved for different reasons. And then they become interested and learn things about, let's say, monetary economics or money itself, which they wouldn't necessarily have thought about before. And of course, there are whole new sets of people thinking about these problems when they see massive amounts of quantitative easing, discussion of modern monetary theory, and a feeling like, well, why do we need to pay taxes if governments can just print more of them? What difference does it make, right? Whether you know, we give the government some money and it increases the number in their database, or whether they just change the number in the database. It's all the same thing, ultimately, right? So, well, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, because there are different side effects, but, you know, it does cause people to question the value of fiat money.
Yeah. So Preston, let's bring you into the discussion here. You know, from your perspective, you know, compared to Adam, are relative noobs here, but as your perspective, you know, as an investor, you have a long history in business and investing here in the United States and abroad, I'm sure. Can you bring that perspective to bear? Like, how do you feel as a person who has kind of grown up in this fiat age, this Keynesian age, as an investor, you know, kind of have the script flipped and have this sort of alternative, you know, money really kind of ready to maybe flip the US dollar and change our economy, you know, fundamentally?
I mean, I feel pretty small having a conversation after following Adam, who was doing this 2 decades before I even came onto the scene, 2.5 decades before I came onto the scene. So I'm honored to be here with him talking about this stuff. I approached it initially from a way different perspective. You know, Adam is extremely technical. He understands the monetary policy. He understands, like, all these different facets that surround it, where I kind of came at it from a very specific angle, which was the finance angle and the global macro kind of vantage point. And so for me in 2015, having been a market participant through the 2008 crisis, and then kind of seeing how central bankers responded to the 2008 crisis and saying, this is not sustainable, what's happening here. This is not a free and open market when you're going and you're creating a bunch of money. You're then inserting it in through the bond market and then just drastically bidding the prices of those fixed income securities. Like, that's not a free and open market. And so by around the 2015 timeframe for me, I was saying, this is just not sustainable. Like, what in the hell is going on? Right? Like, how is this going to, they just can't keep doing this. And so it led me to, well, what are some of the alternatives out there to gold? You know, I had heard Bitcoin, didn't really understand the fact that it was this fixed monetary baseline type currency. And as soon as I had heard that through encryption, proof of work, and all these wonderful things that Adam has been so aggressively involved in for a long time, I started wrapping my head around some of those things. And I was like, there is something here, and this could offer a major solution to everything that we're seeing and all this manipulation that we're seeing playing out by central bankers in order to prop up, you know, the global economy through these liquidity insertions straight to the top in the fixed income market. So that's kind of the angle that I came from. I like to learn about the technology and things like that, but compared to Adam, I mean, it's a joke what I understand from a technical standpoint on how the protocol functions.
It is a really amazing thing. I actually was just speaking with a friend a couple hours ago, Daniel Prince. I was talking with him on his podcast, and you know, we spent half an hour just kind of basking in the glow of Bitcoin. Right now, at this particular time, it's amazing. It's kind of a gift, right? That we have this lifeboat as an option in this just incredible time. Like, if we didn't have it, I think a lot of us would feel, you know, a lot less hopeful. And I would like to hear what you guys, you know, both think about that. Like, let's start with Adam. Has Bitcoin or the presence of Bitcoin affected you as an individual in any way in your, you know, kind of worldview?
Well, I did a panel discussion with Nick Szabo and David Traum at a conference a few months back. And it was interesting to see the different opinions. I mean, not opinions, but the different directions people came at things. So I think, you know, originally with the electronic cash systems, I was thinking it'd be pretty cool to have bearer and anonymous electronic cash. And the fact that it's bearer was like very important and interesting to me, because it's sort of more self-sovereignty and nobody can seize it from you, nobody can tell you have it. It's like these kind of things, right? And it seemed like Nick Szabo was maybe coming at it a bit more from a digital gold perspective. I mean, he called his proposal BitGold, after all, right? So he was more thinking about it from that point of view. And it seemed like David Chaum was more interested in the privacy, but less in the hard money. So I think Nick Szabo and myself were interested in, you know, very hard money that can't be seized, can't be frozen, all that kind of thing. And David was more thinking about it as, well, the video's online now, finally, after a while, but without putting words in their mouth. But anyway, that was the way that the views seem to break down, but or the ways that people got into it. But I think the combination is more powerful than the individual pieces, right? So if it both has the digital gold and the bearer money, that's even more interesting. So that was a slight shift for me. You know, if I'd had that combination of views and a few other people had, maybe people would have figured things out faster. You know, because people were interested to build something, they just couldn't quite figure out how to make it work. You know, about sort of 10 years before Bitcoin, I would say.
When did you realize that something like Bitcoin was important? I mean, way back when, before you, you know, you guys started talking about what led you to the Cypherpunks mailing list and like inspired you to like, you realized, hey, you know, something like this needs to happen. I want to live in a world where this exists.
It was about sort of, you know, so the vibe of the internet in general is sort of changing the balance of power. The individual can self-publish. So, you know, a lot of those things become taken for granted now, but there are still kind of battles between mainstream media and governments wanting to control media output, particularly in some countries. And so the internet was very liberating from that point of view, but you could see that it was also very monitored. People could, you know, the ISPs were tracking subscriber street addresses and bank information. against IP addresses and keeping logs of it. So clearly you didn't have that much privacy unless you weren't careful. So people were, cypherpunks were interested to assert rights in the digital realm by encrypting things, building things like Tor. Well, this was a little bit before Tor, but you know, building anonymity networks, building and running anonymous remailers. And it was clear that a big missing part of this was, okay, you could browse online, you could download free things, but if you couldn't pay for anything, or as soon as you paid for something, you'd identify yourself. That's not very interesting. We needed electronic cash to, you know, be able to transact online. And so people had theories about reputation and pseudonyms and being able to transact pseudonymously. So Weidai's B-Money starts talking about, you know, the ability to basically conduct commerce based on pseudonyms with no, you know, no resort to courts and a threat of, you know, imprisonment for contract violation and things like that. It's all sort of voluntary trade based on reputations and pseudonyms and electronic cash. So I think those things are pretty interesting to see. And, you know, Bitcoin brings a lot of them together.
Absolutely. Preston, how about you? Has Bitcoin changed your worldview in any way?
You know, I try to think about what it would be like if it wasn't in place. And I think what you would continue to have around the globe is this competitive devaluation of currency in order to engineer GDP growth amongst all the nations. I mean, it's almost like you have a tragedy of the commons amongst nations in order to devalue their currencies fast enough in order to prop up their organic and local GDP. So if you take Bitcoin out of that equation and you think about how much longer would that persist, I think now you're stepping into the point where you just can't do the quantitative easing route. Now you have to be doing the universal basic income as well in order to keep the social unrest from breaking apart, because we've pretty much only been using globally quantitative easing. So if you didn't have something like Bitcoin that could potentially step in and provide a solution to this mess, this competitive devaluation that you're seeing, I think what you would do is you would just get to much more of an extreme than what we're already seeing today. And from a social unrest standpoint, that would be a really kind of scary scenario to think about where that would go. Because in my opinion, it's just going to drive the polarization between the wealthy and basically everybody else even further apart, as you now are trying to teeter between UBI and QE as the insertion point for liquidity. That balancing act that they have to manage without something like Bitcoin in the equation just gets to the point where I don't even think it's manageable. And I think you get into a very scary social unrest scenario. So for me, when I see Bitcoin now offering a solution to that in a manner where you're redistributing the wealth, because I mean, that's truly what's, in my opinion, going to play out here, is you're going to have one of the biggest redistribution of wealth that we've ever seen on a global scale. And that's what needs to happen in order to adjudicate a lot of this social unrest, polarization of social classes that you're seeing. It's pretty exciting for me to see that there's a solution in place that could maybe alleviate some of that from playing out if that solution wasn't in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Corey, did you want to weigh in on this one?
No, I'm actually just browsing the chat. We've got a lot of questions from the crowd, and I actually wanted to pull in one from Daniel Prince, who you were on with earlier. He's in there and had a question for Preston. I actually know Adam's talked on this before as well, and it fits right into this conversation. So we'll start with Preston, I guess. You know, for value investors, or even just for stock market investors generally, or macro investors that, you know, traditionally have had stocks as part of their portfolio, when you look at listed companies today, large cap stocks, like, where is the value? What's the rationale? And just kind of break down how that's different today in this current environment than it may have been even a year ago, let alone, you know, 15 years ago or something like that.
Love this question. So what I find fascinating, because for me, when I'm doing evaluation on a business, I'm looking at the past performance of the free cash flows. I'm saying, hey, here's what the trend was historically. If I'm assuming that the enduring competitive advantage of the business is going to be sustained into the future, well, then I make an estimate of what I think those future free cash flows are going to look like. I do a discount cash flow based on that, and I come up with a price, right? So when you now have Bitcoin as a unit of account, and you go back 10 years, let's just say we're pulling up Amazon, for example, and I go back and I redenominate their previous revenues and their previous free cash flows into Bitcoin. So I go back, let's just say I'm looking at a 2015 number, right? And I have to use the price of Bitcoin at that point in time in order to redenominate those revenues. And I do this for, let's just say, 10 years of period. What you see when you look at it in fiat terms is that the revenues are going up, that the free cash flows are going up. But if you go back and you redenominate all these things in Bitcoin, guess what the trend looks like? The trend is going down. You're exactly right, Brady. So now if I'm doing a discount cash flow on something that has a downward slope on the free cash flows, well, guess what? I'm getting a much different price at today's price, at the today's valuation, than what I'm getting whenever I'm using it in fiat terms. And so what I think is going to be really surprising for a lot of people, especially as we go into this next 4-year cycle when you start to see the price run, is some of that math that very few, nobody's doing this kind of math today for understanding the value of a company in terms of Bitcoin being their unit of account. When you start going back and you do that math, all of a sudden these valuations are way out of whack to the high side. Like they're being bid way higher than their value is, as long as fiat's still being used as their unit of account inside the business. Well, you start changing that and you start using Bitcoin, and I would imagine if you go into a miner's business and you start looking at how they're denominating their unit of account inside their business, they're heavily denominated in Bitcoin. And so if I was going to do a valuation on a company like that, that has free cash flows, it's managing their risks at certain points in the cycle through derivatives or whatever, in order to have a nice projected free cash flow because they're well managed, all of a sudden, the valuations on businesses like that look a whole lot different. And so I think you're going to see your smarter investors that understand what this is, understand that we're having a huge adjustment in what people are saying is the unit numerator for measuring value. And when they do that, they're going to start getting way different valuations than they're seeing today. So that's my point of view. I'm curious to hear how Adam thinks through it.
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that Bitcoin is pretty volatile though, right? So, but definitely repricing things in Bitcoin is almost nothing else you could have invested in that would have held on to value or seen value appreciation in the same way. But you have to have a stomach for the 85% pullbacks to get the 100-time upside. So, I guess some people are starting to look at it as a portfolio allocation, like Paul Tudor Jones, the hedge fund investor with a few billion dollars under management. Sounded like he bought $100 million worth of Bitcoin, representing about 2% of his assets under management. So, you know, the average sort of consumer investor person who's looking at the market doesn't necessarily think about asset allocation and doing things with different risk profiles. But you know, if you put 2% into something with a potentially big upside and you're wrong and it falls drastically, well, you can't lose more than 2% clearly. So it's not that painful. Now, personally, given our views, we're probably inclined to go a lot heavier than that. But you know, for anybody, I think that the 2% allocation makes sense. They don't have to believe in it even. You just have to see that a lot of people find it interesting and look at the price history of it. And the other thing with the quantitative easing, I mean, it's a really messed up economic environment in my perspective, because there's so much quantitative easing and everything you might normally invest and diversify into is looking really shaky, right? The stock market pulled back a lot, and it's almost back to the previous levels, but it doesn't really quite make sense because, you know, presumably a lot of these companies are not going to do very well for the next year or two. Maybe some of them won't even survive, but nevertheless, the stock indexes are almost back. And then what else are you going to invest in, right? If your bonds are looking pretty bad, just the interest rate, even like long-term government bonds, real estate, I guess people are thinking that a lot of people will work remote, so the property prices in more expensive cities residentially might fall. So real estate investing is looking bad. Presumably rent defaults are way up. So I think that's what's causing a number of people to start talking about Bitcoin actively as an asset to invest in, who have normally been talking about other things, you know. So the rich dad, poor dad, famous sort of leveraged real estate investor is now talking about Bitcoin and gold as well, for example. So more people are starting to realize that something's different in this environment, and they've got to be defensive.
Yeah.
And Brady, it's going to be interesting if these people do take a 2% position, because I know from the last cycle, if you start out with a 2% position and you're into the bull portion of the curve, mm-hmm. and you're still in the game, call it 4 or 5 months later, your 2% allocation has turned into maybe 3 or 4% allocation. Not by choice, it's by performance, right? And so that creates a very interesting dynamic where even if you're an investor and you're not very speculative at all in your approach, it has the ability to bring out some animal spirits that I don't care who you are, it'll bring out the animal spirits in your approach.
Oh yeah. I mean, Bitcoiners have become very strong in resisting those animal spirits. And the only thing I think that can really overcome it is just absolute conviction in what's happening here. So shout out to all the strong hands and the hodlers of last resort out there. And, you know, Satoshi had the original and only investment advice, you know, you might as well get some in case it catches on, just get a little. And that still holds true today. So we're giving it out right now.
Brady, I wanted to just add one other thing to what Adam said. You know, he was talking about, he doesn't think a lot of people are going to be looking at it from a unit of account standpoint and at least where we're at right now. And I completely agree with him. I think most people are looking at it from, hey, let me just put 1% of my portfolio into this. What I'm talking about is more if this thing goes to some of the levels that Plan B's model is suggesting it could go. And if it even runs further than that, then I think you're going to start getting into what I was describing, which is this shift and how you think about your unit numerair of how you're measuring value. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it's just going to, you're now stepping into a whole different level of adoption than where we're at today.
So what do you think about the Goldman Sachs investor report? So people were kind of waiting to see what happened, and it wasn't very complimentary. It's like not investable or something, but the comments seems so off base or confused, you know, like, oh, it's not scarce because there are lots of copies, or, you know, some sort of pretty confusing analysis that wouldn't have looked out of place like 5 years ago when people were getting to grips with it. So I think some people were a bit put off by it, but personally, it made me much more confident in Plan B's kind of next halving projections, never mind this halving, because it says that basically we're much earlier than we might have thought, which is even the, you know, the cream of the professional investors just don't get it at all. And usually those guys are the smart money and a couple of years ahead of the curve, and they're like way behind the curve. So
those weren't even 2017 arguments. Those were 2015 arguments.
Right, yeah.
I mean, Goldman Sachs is well behind, you know, JP Morgan at this point. Like, you know.
Yeah. That when I saw, and the only thing I could think is, hey, you got some 22-year-old kid that just graduated from some Ivy League school who had to slap a slide deck together and it got out. I don't know. It was beyond laughable though.
Yeah.
The funny thing is you kind of hope that that's who put it together, but it's not.
Hey, I think it was Adam that had a tweet like, we need these people to be in the dark because they're going to be the ones that are buying at 100 and 200,000.
I was sort of reposting something that Alistair Milne wrote. So he's a crypto fund manager in Europe. I feel that's an interesting perspective, basically, that, you know, because that's part of the story is, you know, if you're early and people still don't understand, once they do understand, the markets, you know, they're going to be forced to understand by the market, and then the price is higher at that point, right? So it just says there's a lot more, I mean, it's an information asymmetry thing, right? We thought, oh, they're catching up, the information asymmetry is getting better, and it was like a kind of reset. It's like, oh no, the asymmetry is enormous, there's a long way to go. So
I think your Goldman Sachs and a lot of your Wall Streeters are going to have a couple key inflection points when you're going to have a lot of them start onboarding. The first is when you go through your previous all-time high of 20K. That's going to be a huge wake-up call where the market's then telling them, I'm wrong. I think your next inflection point is when the total market cap in USD terms goes over a trillion, which I can't remember where that's at. I think it's like 86,000 a coin or somewhere 60 something. I can't remember, but it's somewhere
55-ish,
something like that. Yeah. That's going to be your next big inflection point. And then I think when the price per coin in USD terms goes over 100,000, and also on the euro side, when it goes over that amount, I think that's going to be another third really huge wake up call where your high net worth individuals are going to start saying, all right, I'm clearly missing something here.
Yeah.
How in the world can something like this run like that for this many years? And I think that you're going to have each one of those three points are going to be really key for the protocol and for the community.
I mean, I've heard you talk about this before, Preston, the idea of escape velocity, and we're all familiar with, you know, technological adoption S-curves. And the phenomenon, you know, when you hit exponential growth is that, you know, it takes a long time. It's really slow on that curve. It seems super early the whole time until boom, you hit the, you know, elbow of the asymptote and then it's just gone. Do you think we might reach escape velocity if we hit those like 1, 2, and 3 kind of stages?
So I think the thing that is often lost in this discussion where we're talking about these key price points is like if this was a picture or a painting, so like that's the focus or the subject of the painting is those key points that we were saying. But if you were going to look at the landscape and the backdrop of the picture, you're having central banks bailing out municipalities. You're having central banks just printing at levels that are not even understandable in today's terms. Like all of those things that they're going to have to be doing are now also playing out in the background as you have this thing, Bitcoin, blowing through these crazy price points that have this enormous amount of marketing and branding power that's being played on CNBC and all those things. So I think it's the combination of both of those things that your high net worth individuals that are going to be buying at 100, 200 and everybody else at that point, because the onboarding with through like GBTC and some of these other things are crazy what kind of power that pushes into the price. I think when you combine all of those aspects in harmony with each other, yes, I think that is definitely a real possibility for this incoming cycle, way higher than I think it's given credit for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently GBTC is, I mean, just the users of GBTC have been buying over 1.5 times the freshly mined coins. However, I saw somebody saying that is partly people moving Bitcoins into it because there's a arbitrage you can do with GBTC because it trades above NAV and what have you. So they may not be completely buying it. Some of it's existing Bitcoin moving into the fund, which then isn't a net purchase, right? It's just a kind of tax planning or arbitrage thing. But nevertheless, I mean, it shows that, you know, because before the halving, we had the usual death spiral story that people come up with every time, or more recently some you know, concerns about, well, who's going to buy all the mined coins. It doesn't look to be a problem. Like, you know, there's not just a few places that have a lot of retail buyers seem to be absorbing more than that as net buyers. Of course, there's always a seller for every buyer, but you know, when the retail people are buying and just holding, I think that's a pretty healthy situation. That you know, they're buying all of the new stock. That basically means that there is very little supply to be bought.
And there's always a lag, or at least there has been on the couple of data points we have of previous halvings. There's a little bit of a lag, and I think the reason you see the lag is because when you look at the balance sheet for these miners, their treasury of Bitcoin that they're sitting on is based on the previous reward flow. So as you adjust that reward flow post-halving, that treasure chest of Bitcoin that's sitting on their balance sheet that they're being paid in is denominated in Bitcoin. As they chew through that in order to sustain operations for their variable costs and their fixed costs that they have, as they chew through that and they wind it down, I think then their new treasury is based on that new reward flow. And so if I was just going to put a time stamp on that, you're talking 30 days to a quarter that's playing out, that you're having a little bit of selling pressure that's causing that price to not immediately start jumping based off of the new reward flows. But once the new hashing comes in there, and I'm very curious to hear Adam's position, because I know you guys are mining and you're probably much more well-versed on this than I am.
Well, we're watching what happens to the difficulty, because we do a couple of things. One is we mine on our own account, and I'm personally mining pretty heavy too. And my approach to mining is to mine and keep the coins, like not sell any of them. But of course, that kind of drains your cash flow. So. Yeah. It's effectively similar to, dollar cost buying or something, but hopefully with a discount. But in terms of watching the halving, so the halving fell halfway between a two-week difficulty period. So the first adjustment, which took place a little over a week afterwards, was -6% on difficulty. And the current one, which is still a week away from completing, is we would assume it would be bigger, because you wouldn't be averaging. It's like, I think the difficulty before the halving was like 120x a hash, and then you were looking at a much lower hash rate, but you would only get the average for the second part, because the first part was unaffected by the halving. So now that we've had, in a week or so, we'll have a full period exposed to the reduced reward. And there is a website that gives you a projection, and it looks like it's going to be about a 15% fall. The first one was a 6% fall. So it's combined, that's a pretty big fall, right? And the price has picked up a bit since the halving. And of course, it wasn't that long before the halving. The price was much lower than now, right? So I think the price swings and the hash rate adjustment is more than, halving. Actually, so and the equipment is getting more efficient too. So the older generation of equipment is about 100 joules per terahash. It's kind of just a way to talk about how much mining you can do per kilowatt hour kind of thing. And the newer equipment is, there's 50 joules and now 40 joules, a little bit below 40, like 30 something. That could see, if people replace their equipment, that could see the hash rate grow. So really, really what matters is, in terms of the economics of it, is how much is the electricity costing you. So if you've replaced the equipment with equipment that can produce twice as much hash rate on the same electrical cost, then the hash rate's going to look higher. So I think really what matters is, how much money is getting spent on electricity. We'll see what happens in a week, but I think, the new equipment is pretty profitable. A lot of people were kind of strategically waiting for the halving and difficulty adjustment before, deciding, making their final decision on adding some more hash rate or buying some equipment to get hosted. So we'll see how it plays out. But it doesn't look like it's going to be particularly dramatic. So, I mean, there are Yeah, different people doing different things in terms of keeping the coins versus selling the coins. So you never know about, you know, what portion are sold for electricity. It's hard to estimate exactly. Go ahead,
Adam. I'm of the opinion that the price drop that we had in March was, you know, a huge part of that was just the liquidity on the macro side that caused this. And I think because it was so deep and so unexpected, I think it sucked a lot of those Bitcoins off the balance sheet of a lot of these miners much earlier than they had anticipated, sucked them dry, and then you come up and then you now have the halving event, which then took the remaining bit. So I think, I guess my opinion is, I think we're going to see the price get a little bit more bullish earlier on post-halving than we have seen historically because of that event that preceded it.
It's possible, yeah. There are quite a lot of variables, but so it's hard to tell. But the deleveraging in the regular financial system, of course, is pretty drastic because a lot of finance is leveraged, where people are borrowing against portfolio to do more things. And so, you know, if you're 50% leveraged and the price falls, you start to get nervous real fast, and then people will sometimes sell the quality asset because it has the most remaining value, right? So you saw some pretty weird stuff, like, you know, prices on low risk bonds with negative yields and stuff. So it didn't really make sense, but it was just because there's more sellers than buyers. Nothing wrong with those assets, right? But people were deleveraging. And Bitcoin saw a bit of that. I mean, presumably a little bit of Bitcoin was sold to rescue the leverage on regular portfolios. But of course, Bitcoin itself has its leverage platform. So BitMEX particularly was, people were saying that wiped out $270 million worth of liquidations on BitMEX in a, you know, very short period of time, where the market, they actually took the market offline briefly. So it's a bit disorderly. So I think you're right that caused a, you know, it takes a little bit for the market to rebuild confidence after things like that. So, but I think that actually some of the, you know, the size of those markets shrunk a bit, like of the leverage betting. So if the volatility gets super high, people get a bit burnt and less inclined to do that again. So probably that changed the dynamic a bit.
So Adam brought up the bond market earlier, about 15 minutes ago or so, and I made a note to ask Preston about this. Concierge boating accidents on Twitter asked Preston to expand on his thoughts surrounding the implosion of the bond market as it relates to Bitcoin.
So this one, I think a lot of people in traditional finance, particularly Wall Streeters, don't see eye to eye with me on this one. So my point of view is you got every central banker stepping in, adjusting the government bond rate, the yields on it, bidding the price to the moon, and the yields are collapsing down to 0% pretty much all around the world. So as you get to zero collectively on a global scale, not only does it just totally mess up your mechanisms for doing discount cash flow models in order to determine the value of everything on the planet, but you get to a certain point where if you drive that price into the negative territory, what's stopping somebody from saying, hey, I'm just going to go to the bank, I'm going to take out a bunch of money, and I'm going to stick it in a safety deposit box because that's going to give me a higher return than owning this negative yielding bond, right? And what's really fascinating now as they're continuing to print is now they're saying, well, we're going to have this cap on yield because the governments cannot allow interest rates to go up because of the debt that they have to continue to issue, and they just can't allow interest rates to go up. So now they're saying, well, we're going to peg the interest rates at 0.5% or whatever percent that they're going to say. And then they're going to step out into the longer duration of the curve, and they're going to say, we're not only going to do that with short duration bonds, we're going to do it with long duration bonds, and we're going to peg the yield at 1%. So what that effectively means is if anyone tries to sell beyond that 1% level, because it's inversely correlated, right? If anyone tries to sell beyond that 0.5% level, we'll be a buyer no matter what. right? So what you're doing is you're warping the entire risk profile of every security literally on the planet through this model. And so I think it's going to continue to persist. And I think from outsiders that maybe aren't nearly as dialed into the market, they're looking at the bond market and they're saying, well, there's not a lot of risk here. The volatility on the yield isn't going anywhere. It's really stable. That's how they're looking at the risk. They're saying, oh, well, the yield's been 0.5%. It hasn't moved, so it's not risky. And they're solely focused in on the volatility of the yield. But if they could look behind the curtain as to what's actually taking place in reality, you got central bankers that they're shoveling the money out the door as fast as they can in order to suck those issuance off the market and replace it with liquidity, right?
Right.
I think you get to a point, especially when you have something in the backdrop, call it Bitcoin, where the price is going crazy and it's going up in a major way, like we expect to see here in the coming 12 months, where people who are holding those securities are starting to say, I just need to remove 1 or 2% of my exposure to this thing that doesn't move in price because it's being pegged at whatever yield, right? And then it starts flowing into other markets. And when you have that, then you have that erosion of trust, because that's really the key word here, where it becomes a qualitative thing opposed to a quantitative thing. That's when the selling starts to accelerate and these central banks are having to shovel the money out the door faster and faster and faster because there's such an aggressive selling. And there they are trying to sustain that 0.5% yield or that 0.25% yield on the bond market. So that's how I see it breaking down. And once that gets to be at such a ridiculous level, well, then it goes boom and it happens all at once. So people that are actively involved in these markets today, they're going to look over there. They're going to say, there's nothing wrong with it. What the heck is that guy talking about? The yield continues to be not volatile at all. But I think you get to a breaking point, and then when that happens, it's going to be like a dam breaks and the water comes flying out of it. It's going to be all at once. And who knows when that's possibly going to happen, because being able to predict that moment is impossible, in my opinion. But that's how I foresee it kind of playing out.
Can I take that out of corporates and into sovereigns a little bit? Because some of these corporate, you know, debt loads are over significantly large, you know, country economies and what they have outstanding. And now you've got the IMF, you know, forecasting that countries are going to move from, what is it, like $6 trillion of debt to $66 trillion in debt over the next few years.
And that's why you have BlackRock to go in there and buy up these corporates, because if they didn't do that, think about what the impact in the market from a psychological standpoint would be. Is everyone would be showing the split in yield between corporates and government bonds. They'd be saying, hey, what's causing this disconnect? This doesn't make any sense. Why is this selling off at epic proportions and yield blowing out to 10% plus when the government bonds are at 0.25%? So you would see that disconnect on the charts. And so I think the government stepping in and saying, we can't allow that disparity to occur, or else it's going to signal to the market that there's something very seriously wrong in the bond market. And so that's this, I mean, you've seen it the last couple of months. They've stepped in and they've literally started buying the debt for corporate junk bonds. It's crazy.
Yeah. So they started off buying bond ETFs, and they legally weren't allowed to do that, but somehow jerry-rigged some sort of, well, they basically did like Raptor 9, like Enron used to do, right? They almost created an SPV to hold this thing, and somehow that's not on their balance sheet. So the Fed is doing off-balance sheet purchasing of bond ETFs.
And the thing that's crazy, like when you really pull back and pull on the thread of what that really means, is you got zombie companies. You got companies that are not adding value to society that need to fail so new companies can step in and replace. Capitalism. I guess I'm describing capitalism, right? You need capitalism to occur. And when you are manipulating the debt market in the manner that you are, you're basically signaling to the market, hey, just go out and borrow. Just assume more risk. I don't care that your income statement is is negative. Go borrow more, take more risk, do these things, you zombies, and stay alive. We'll let you stay alive. That's what they're effectively saying to the marketplace right now.
It's the subprime mortgage crisis for the entire economy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, so okay, let's skip back a little bit, because you know this crack up boom scenario, what we assume is probably the inevitable end at some point, maybe nearer now than it was before this COVID epidemic. So let's assume that we have this escape velocity in the next few years for Bitcoin, given these pressures that we're seeing on it now. Adam, what do you think about, scaling in the next few years? If we don't have like three more cycles to, you know, work and engineer and build this thing out, do you think we're ready now with, you know, Liquid and Lightning and other scaling solutions off-chain?
Well, we are in a much better position than in 2017, let's put it that way. I think Lightning is... And there's lots of pretty easy to use wallets, including ones that take various shortcuts to set you up faster, you know, turbo channels or pre-funded channels, and then migrate behind the scenes. Wallets have got a lot easier to use. I think that helps with usability, like fast transactions, onboarding, more scalable transactions, and cost. The Lightning routing fees are a lot lower. I think there's room for more layer two tech, but it takes time to build tech, and it seemingly takes more time than people would expect to see technology adopted by, you know, just businesses and exchanges. For example, segregated witness, I think, is maybe about 50% adopted or something like that. So, you know, you could get more scale if that was further adopted. The other thing people, you know, wonder about is if the Bitcoin price goes parabolic, you know, late this year, next year, then what's going to happen to the fees? You know, already last week, the fees got up 100 to 200 satoshis per fee byte, depending on your priority of how quickly you wanted to complete your transaction. And it gets kind of, it's relative, right? So of course it's still way cheaper than a wire transfer, but compared to one satoshi a byte, it sounds expensive, right? And I think that's where Liquid helps, because the layer twos are focused on different things. So Lightning is just a kind of more scalable, fast way to use Bitcoin, to store Bitcoin, but makes some security trade-offs. But you know, it's fine for general use. But when you get the sort of big spikes in fee pricing, it seems that it's due to traders, basically. Traders, if they get in a kind of trading frenzy, they want to trade quickly, and they're not going to, you know, put a low price on it and see how long it takes. They're just gonna look on an estimator, what's the fee that's needed in it, and let's say it's a dollar, then you're just gonna stick $2 on it just to be double sure the transaction is in the next very next block. And in isolation that could be okay, but you know, there are other people doing the same thing, and then there's an awful lot of software that just copies what the average fee is. So between the software, which acts like a trading bot to just copy what other people are paying, it doesn't take much until the fees shoot up. And you can sort of see an indication of the effect from the BitMEX effect. So BitMEX does cold storage of their... It's a big leverage trading platform. They do cold storage. They do a payout once every 24 hours, and it's at the same time of day. And at that time of day, they drop a lot of transactions on chain, and it causes the fees to go up. And even though they finish sending them, it takes a few hours for it to come down again. And it's just because all the software is copying, you know, the fees were high, so they think the software thinks it should pay a high fee, so then it keeps paying a high fee. Right. And there's not that much to push it down again. So I think, you know, Liquid could help in the sense that it's not I mean, people use things for what they want to use them for. So you could use it for lots of different things, but basically what it's designed to help with is to make a different security trade-off. So it can handle larger values and different assets like stable coins for trading. And then if it provides a better security model than storing assets on one exchange, so it supports atomic trade, you can take funds on and off exchange within a couple of minutes, and you can move funds between exchanges, and the funds you're moving could be stable coins or Bitcoin or other things. So it's good for traders, basically. Yeah. So given that it offers them advantages, the hope is that if they can be enticed onto that, then they will not cause these fee spikes, and that will give a more pleasant experience for people who are just trying to go about their, you know, their use case for Bitcoin. And it's kind of, you know, it's a bit annoying, right? I mean, I'm in both camps because I like trading, but I also like Bitcoin, the asset class. And like you ask, well, why are people buying Bitcoin? It's because they think it's a fantastic tool for people to use. But when they trade it too heavily, they make it less usable. So I think that presents an argument for specialization of layers. And you see that in other networks, like most networks have layers. So I think that could be part of it as well. And then the other thing which people may not be as aware of is Lightning actually works on top of Bitcoin or Liquid. So you can do that too, or you could potentially bridge them. But so there's a possibility for layers, and the technology could be used to make different layers. Now, of course, you know, every time you use a layer, it's always making some trade-off. And it's not going to be quite as good as being on-chain, because if there was some technical method to make something better, then Bitcoin would already be doing it, right? So you're sort of definitionally giving something up to get the advantage. But nevertheless, like Lightning is better for its use case, which is faster and it's cheaper and it's more scalable. Liquid is better for its use case, which is it's also faster but can handle larger values and multiple assets for trading. So hopefully we get some further adoption. I mean, it does seem like the phenomena that traders and exchanges are somewhat price insensitive, fights against people preemptively doing anything about it. You know, people don't tend to fix the roof when it's not raining. And the exchanges can and do just pass the costs on to the users. And if the users ultimately are price insensitive because, you know, they're already paying $30 or $40 wire transfer fee and tens of basis points, like 0.1, 0.2% commission on the trade, then paying 10 cents versus a dollar versus 1 cent, they don't really care, because like maybe they just paid $100 for the trade, right? So whether it's $100 and 10 cents or $101 doesn't really change the shape of their trading. So that's what it is. So it's not, I think people need to adopt technology and choose businesses that adopt technology, I guess, or, you know, help people use Bitcoin in efficient and useful ways.
So Brady, Adam is too humble here. just going to throw that out there. So his green app, you know, anybody who has concerns about usability of Bitcoin has obviously, they've never used the green app on their smartphone. That's just point blank. You go on the green app, you select what network you want to be Bitcoin. Boom, I push send, you push receive, transaction over. If we want to go on the Liquid, right, I choose the Liquid network, I push send, you push receive, transaction complete, no fees. It's freaking simple. It doesn't get any simpler from a usability standpoint than the green app, right? So when I'm looking at why do we see the adoption rates that we're seeing, it comes down to one thing, man. It's taxes. It's tax implications. Today, I have a friend, his name's Steve. I owed him $20, right? If there was no tax implications, I would have had money in the Liquid network, right? I would have gone onto my Green app. He would have pulled up his and I would have pushed send. He would have pushed receive and I would have given him his $20. Boom, transaction over. The reason I didn't do that today is because I don't want to deal with the tax implications and all that crap, right?
Yep.
So not to mention, I'm of the opinion that my Bitcoin's going to, you know, perform extremely well in the coming 12 months, right? And here's the thing that, so a person who hears that, they're saying this is a bunch of crap. The government is preventing this. No, the government, in my opinion, the taxes across the globe are doing Bitcoin probably one of the biggest services that it could possibly be doing. And here's why. Because the government has these tax implications for a sale, guess what? I'm incentivized to hold my Bitcoin. I'm incentivized to not use it in that manner. I'm incentivized to hodl the living crap out of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, guess what that does for the price? It causes the price to go up, right? They are incentivizing the price to go up through the tax implications. And for where we're at right now in the adoption phase, the really big picture, right? That's what we want. We want that incentive to be in place. And you know what? When the time comes for me to go to Starbucks and buy something on the Liquid network, I've got the app. Adam and his team expertly designed it. It works flawlessly as far as I'm concerned. It's freaking simple. When that day comes, it's built. He did it. And he's just way too humble. It's like, I just want to scream like while he's talking there, dude, you crushed it. You crushed it. You did it. It's in place. Yeah, it wasn't there in 17, but it's there now. And it's amazing. It's when I see Bitcoin Cash rockheads, right, out there doing their bigger blocks and usability stuff, I just smirk. I'm like, this is such a joke. Like, these guys don't get it, right? So anyway, sorry, I get excited and emotional.
I hear you, man. I hear you. I'm with you.
I mean, you're right about the tax implications, that depending on when people bought coins, they, if they're doing last in, first out, they've got to consider that they create a tax hit by using it. I think sometimes there are like de minimis limits. So if it's below some dollar amount, then you can not account for it. And then there is the fact that you mentioned that a lot of people don't want to spend Bitcoin because they don't want to be the pizza guy, or, you know, everybody's got a story about they bought a router or they bought a book or a t-shirt and, you know, how many thousand dollars it is now that they wish they hadn't done it. But I mean, the other thing you can do is just, you know, go onto Swan or Square or something and just buy some more Bitcoin right after or right before, and buy a bit more just in case. Because it doesn't help with the tax implication, but you know, if it's under the cash limit, you got to figure out what that is, and I guess filter those transactions out of your reporting. But yeah, buying more is good. I mean, because that's what I started doing at one point. So I just realized that I don't really want to, you know, use up the coins. So I guess I better buy some more.
I mean, you're going to spend the money anyway, right? So if you can get around the tax implications, yeah.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that analysis before, Preston, about, sovereign taxes actually, incentivizing hodling. And that makes such great sense. It's this is good for Bitcoin and that is good for Bitcoin scenario, because, you know, if they don't tax it and we start using it more, then that's also good for Bitcoin, right? In its own way,
Anti-fragile, man.
Anti-fragile.
I want to pull forward a quick discussion we had with Bitcoin Tina from a few weeks ago, who had a really good point about cap gains taxes on Bitcoin and why that may make basically it's just kind of like one of the great factors that may lead to this being, you know, either this cycle or the next one being more of like a super cycle where we don't have to drop down 80-90%. And it's basically like as this thing spreads and just goes nuts and people, you know, around the world kind of have friends who are credible that they believe talking about Bitcoin, and it just kind of spreads like that, you know. If there's a blow off top each time where it goes up, you know, another 100%, probably, you know, higher than where it probably should, and you don't really know when that is, and you think that you're going to sell the top, but then you miss the top, and then it only goes down, you know, 50% instead of 85%. Well, this whole thing that's worked a few cycles in a row of, you know, really smart OGs selling the top, it's not going to work for a lot of people either this cycle or the next one, because once you factor in cap gains taxes and the fact that you missed selling the top, you're going to lose a lot of Bitcoin, and then nobody will ever do that again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think it's, you know, a lot of people find out the hard way, which is that they get to thinking it'd be fun to day trade Bitcoin. And then, you know, maybe they don't have a lot of spare cash at that point because they're quite heavily into Bitcoin. So they sell some and they hope they can buy it back. And, you know, it often doesn't work out because, like, basically, statistically, most of the gains, the price appreciation in Bitcoin comes from like a dozen days per year. So your biggest risk is actually being out of the market during one of those days. So it just feels like you're safer to just hold on to it. Because if you miss one of those rallies, like, okay, you just undid all of the possible gains that you would be statistically likely to get from being able to buy back at a bit lower. So, you know, if all the gains are concentrated in a short period of time, safest thing is just keep it.
Buy a put option as an insurance policy if that's one of your concerns, that you can put it back on the market at 200,000-300,000. I mean, you're gonna effectively guarantee yourself that you're gonna lose 10% or 15% of your position. But I mean, that's if you're trying to limit and lock in that gain, I guess that's something a person could do if they just want to keep holding their Bitcoins.
Right. So to take some profit by selling sort of out of market long put options. Yeah. That's interesting. And there are a few platforms for doing that. Of course, you do sometimes give up custody by doing that, but it's definitely an alternative to outright selling. And then there are people that, you know, sometimes I've seen people use borrowing money against Bitcoins instead of selling to because selling would trigger the capital gains, and if they need access to money, they borrow. I mean, I guess it can be risky due to the volatility. That's the only point. Don't borrow too much, I guess.
So, Adam, I wanted to ask you a bit about, and we had some questions from Twitter also on this. You guys kind of made a splash with the satellite Git updates. And, you know, this is like kind of cyberpunk nerd, you know, kind of, I guess, toys for those wannabes among us who kind of want to feel like we're, you know, beaming the blockchain down from space, and how rad and cyberpunk that is. It's really cool. So can you tell us about the upgrades to the kit and, you know, like some feedback you've heard about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, the previous version was broadcasting only. You know, you basically had to sync your node first on a regular internet and then connect it to the satellite. And as long as you didn't lose connectivity, as long as you did that within 24 hours, it would generally keep up and it could tolerate, you know, a power cut for a few hours and things like that. So it could tolerate up to 24 hours of sort of power disruption and things. But the new version has four times the frequency spectrum. So it was 300 kilohertz, now 1.2 gigahertz. So 1.2 megahertz, so four times as much spectrum allocation. But then a lot of other optimizations on top of that to bring it to over 25 times the raw, like the usable bandwidth, basically. So with that massive increase in bandwidth, we were able to support full download. So you can basically, you know, be in a cabin in northern Canada with, you know, a generator or solar power and battery packs or something, and pretty much sync the node from scratch. And it takes about 20 days. But there are three different areas of the world that have two satellite dishes covering them, sort of overlaps in the coverage areas. And if you're in one of those areas, you can get two dishes and receive both data streams, and then you can get it a full sync in about 10 days. And there's a little bit of room for optimization, so we can probably make it a bit faster. So I mean, you got the full sync, which is pretty nice. And for some parts of the world, it's expensive to get enough bandwidth to sync a Bitcoin node, or to stay synced even. You know, it's maybe 10 gigs a month or something like that. So it's quite a bit of bandwidth to most people. The initial sync is, it's always growing, but it's about 250 gigs at the moment. We have some compression, so it comes down to, I think, about 215 with a sort of lossless compression, which is nice. It's kind of saves some bandwidth. And then the other thing we changed is we increased the coverage a bit, so we have another coverage zone, and we're selling equipment. In the previous one, you had to buy, go buy parts from instructions on Amazon, and people were a bit nervous about, like, well, what if I got the wrong part? Will it be compatible? And you had to, install your own software. So it wasn't quite as polished. It was more like for, somebody with maybe some amateur system administration on Linux kind of experience, right? That was the kind of bar before. But now there's actually, we changed the coding standard so that it works with a standard called DVB S2. The previous was a kind of ad hoc protocol that we developed in-house. So this new standard means there's more accelerated hardware you can buy. So there's two kits, a basic kit and a pro kit, and they do the hardware accelerated decoding. So the pro kit has support for two dishes, so it can decode both the streams from both dishes at once, and you connect it using Ethernet, so you can connect it to like a home network or a small office, and it broadcasts using UDP multicast, which is this kind of streaming kind of internet protocol, so that's restricted to a LAN. So it basically broadcasts through your LAN.
Nice.
All the data, so you can have multiple nodes on your LAN. And the basic one is USB connected and one satellite dish. So yeah, I mean, people have been buying lots of them. Like we had to order a couple more batches of equipment, and the pro kit is selling in a bigger ratio than we expected. So I guess people, as you say, like their cypherpunk toys. So yeah.
I definitely want one. Okay, let's take the Canada cabin scenario, and I can sync my node up. How can I broadcast transactions?
Yeah, so you do need a way to send your transaction, and there are a few options. Like, it doesn't include that. It doesn't include the send back feature at this point. We're interested to fill that functionality gap in.
So that is possible?
Not with this satellite today.
Okay.
But there are independent satellite communication equipment you can buy with services that can do that. So one of them is a thing called an Iridium Go, which is a kind of battery-powered Wi-Fi hotspot that runs on basically the same network as the satellite phones. So it's actually really, really slow. It's like 2400 baud, so it's incredibly slow. But it's enough to send a Bitcoin transaction in a few seconds, right? So you can buy these things. They're like probably $300. They have a service plan there, right? Because you've basically got the equivalent of a satellite phone service plan. So it's going to be a monthly cost. Another one is the Hughes BGAN, which is a bit faster. It's 384 kilobits bidirectional internet. So it's enough to get by on. But you wouldn't want to sync a Bitcoin node on it because it'd get expensive. So you can sort of combine things, basically.
Right.
But we're interested to, be able to support bidirectional as well. It'll be like in a later product version.
It's awesome. I love it. All right.
Couldn't you go HF radio as well as for on the transmission side?
Yeah, people have been doing that. So Rodolfo Novak, who's one of the Canadian Bitcoiners, has been experimenting with high frequency, low RUS stuff, and succeeded in sending a transaction down to somebody in California. So it can be done. It's very low bandwidth. You've got takes a while to send not many bits, but that's okay for transactions. So this is different type of equipment. But I think the idea of having kind of internet independent Bitcoin is interesting. So where I am in Malta, there was, you know, the Arab Spring, the revolutions in Egypt, south up here, in Tunisia, in different places. So, you know, in Egypt, they turned off the internet connection and GSM and things like that until the, you know, the revolution was done, and then it all came back on again. So, you know, if at that point in the country, the local economy is disrupted, the local currency is probably not looking very attractive, and you've got some global hard money, you need to transact it at a point where it counts, right? If it's your insurance policy, then you want your sat phone and your Bitcoin, and you want to be able to transact your Bitcoin. So, this gives you a way to do that. It's like a kind of insurance policy, right? So it's sort of attractive to have kind of independence. Like, it's something that works globally without relying on infrastructure. And of course, it's relying on satellites, which is another kind of infrastructure, but it's not local infrastructure. You know, something that one government does is unlikely generally to have any effect on it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I love that work personally, and I'll be picking one up as a summer project. I'm excited to try it out. I will obviously be talking about it on Twitter. Thanks so much, guys. We've kind of reached the end of our time, and I'd love to ask you, you know, if you guys have any final words or something you want to say to the audience out there before we sign off.
I have one final question for these guys too.
Nice.
If you guys want to just like finish that way. Which is the most likely country around the world to adopt Bitcoin as an officially accepted state currency? And let's limit this to like top 30 or top 50 economies. So like the Turkeys and Irans and Argentinas of the world, like which one do you think is the most likely to do that, and why?
Great question.
Adam?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a very interesting question. I think they've got to, the first one that does it will be interesting because they'll have an advantage, right? They can accumulate quietly before doing it. So that's been people's, I've talked to people who have been trying to seed this idea in central banks, like you should do this, go buy $1 billion worth of Bitcoin and then announce you've done it. But I'm not sure which ones would actually do it. But I think there are sovereign wealth funds that presumably have Bitcoin positions or mining positions at this point. So it may happen sort of in stages that way. I couldn't say which, but
I think the ones that you named are going to be at the top of the list, because I think from their vantage point and the way that they're seeing the price charts, it's much more obvious to the countries that you named that there's something here than the ones that do have strong currencies in the face of this. So they might be the first ones to see it simply because the charts are so 1920s Germany gold chart looking type environment to them. I don't necessarily know that you're going to have somebody a country that comes out and says, all right, declaration, we're now a Bitcoin type country. I think what you're going to find is it's going to be this, just like on the individual level where you have people dipping their toe in the water with a 1% or 2% allocation, as they get more comfortable with it, it then slowly starts to become a much more significant position size, even at a sovereign level. So, it's going to be interesting.
I mean, there are a number of countries that have, in the last like decade, maybe run into trouble repatriating gold. So, you know, there's people who have, I think Germany had some gold in the US and it took them years to get it back. And there's a country at the moment that's suing the UK to get their gold back. I guess the UK disagrees with the regime, so they're not giving it to them. But it's kind of an analog of, you know, not your keys, not your coins. If you've got gold in other countries, it doesn't necessarily do you any good. So, you know, people are seeing that they need to take possession of their gold. So maybe countries will start to, you know, they hold foreign currency reserves, they hold gold reserves. Maybe it's time to start building up that Bitcoin reserve.
One of the things that I'll add on top of that idea is, I think in the world right now, everyone looks at the dollar and they're saying, it's so strong, it's only getting stronger, and they're seeing that as a good thing. But I think what will transition here in the coming 2 years is that they're going to find out that the dollar getting so strong is actually a snake eating the tail of itself. Because it's so strong, now it has to start to devour itself. And I think that's something that has not entered the Wall Street narrative whatsoever, is that through the dollar strength, it could actually cause major, major problems down the road. And I think it's not being viewed that way at all.
Well, I mean, there's something like that happened with the Swiss franc. The currency also tends to get used as a hedge. So people will buy Swiss francs when there's uncertainty. So you saw the dollar go up and the Swiss franc go up. I think the Swiss franc was the only major currency that's actually up against the dollar slightly right now. And this was some years ago, but there was a point at which they decided enough was enough, and they devalued it because it was hurting their exports. And people were hoarding their currency, and it made their, you know, domestically produced goods that they're exporting too expensive. So they started printing money and buying foreign stocks with it. So I don't know, like the US currency valuation, it's a bit harder to predict because it has the world reserve kind of advantage, but it is going to hurt exports, and it seems artificial too, right? The dollar got stronger in it for a period there, like earlier this year, but it starts to pull back quite a bit. So it's getting closer to where it was compared to a number of currencies.
Well, I'll go ahead and answer my own question. So selfishly, because I spend a lot of time there and have family in Turkey, and I'm really hoping that's one where, I mean, it's already Bitcoin crazy. I think they have the highest per capita ownership or something like that. There's Bitcoin stores everywhere, and BTC Turk is kicking butt, and there's a reason that Binance has employees and offices there and stuff like that. So I'm kind of hoping it's Turkey. And obviously they have the experience with the four devaluations and kind of a weak lira right now and instability in the region. So it kind of does make sense that might be one. But if I were going to pull a wild card, and this is on the sovereign wealth fund angle, and also a small country that actually is in a meaningful geopolitical location and has made lots and lots of inroads into Silicon Valley, so I would assume probably has had lots of exposure to people talking to them about Bitcoin, it would actually be Malaysia. And the Khazanah Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is like 60 to 65 billion. And they seem like somebody that, to me, you know, maybe there's somebody that just gets red-pilled and, you know, has some allocation out of that 60, 65 and, you know, pulls the Malaysian Sovereign Wealth Fund version of the Paul Tudor Jones and starts allocating.
So that's
my wild card.
What about Switzerland? So there's something similar about, Switzerland was one of the last major currencies to, I mean, it's a smaller country, but it has a lot of offshore wealth packed in there because of the banking sector. So its currency is more significant than the population of the country would suggest. But it was partly strong, I think, because low inflation and because it was the last currency to go off a partial gold peg. And they had a referendum a few years ago to try and reintroduce the gold peg. So I thought it'd be interesting for them to, they have a direct democracy, so you can, people can put forward a proposal, and if it gets enough votes, it's hard for the government constitutionally to turn it down. So people are saying like, well, let's have a referendum in Switzerland to reintroduce the gold standard, but make it a Bitcoin standard this time, like a partial peg. So that could be interesting.
So much of it's going to come down to the leadership of the people managing those particular sovereign wealth funds or economies. And if that personality at the top of that organizational structure is a deep critical thinker, somebody who goes and dives into this, understands the technical pieces of it. You could have a country that you're not even expecting kind of start taking a much more significant position than ones that you are expecting simply because of that leader that's in that position. I think that that could be some of your wild cards that maybe people aren't even expecting.
Mm-hmm. All right, gentlemen, really appreciate your time. This was a ton of fun.
I just want to say I'm a huge fan of Adam, and just wanted to thank him publicly for all of his contributions to the space. I'm a firm believer that proof of work is a instrumental part to the incentive structure of why Bitcoin has been so successful. And I mean, he's the guy. So Adam, it was really an honor to be doing this with you.
Oh, thanks. I mean, it was a long time ago for me, right? The proof of work thing was in 97, but it seemed like people were quickly thinking about it as digital gold, but you know, it took a long time until somebody like Satoshi figured out some of the missing bits of the design to make it actually work as a currency. And here we are. So that's great. So it's been a lot of fun hanging out.
Yep. Thanks, Adam.
And if anybody wants to buy some Bitcoin, sign up at swanbitcoin.com/Preston. And you'll get $10 of free Bitcoin when you sign up.
You guys are too kind.
All right. Thanks, guys. Take care. Thanks to Dr. Back and Preston for joining us. You can follow Adam at Adam3US at ADAM3, the number 3US on Twitter, and follow Preston at Preston Pish at PrestonPysh. You'll find Blockstream online at blockstream.com and the Investors Podcast Network at theinvestorspodcast.com. On behalf of the Swan team, thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode and found it useful. Join us live next time if you can. Jump into our Swan Signal Telegram chat room. We have a lively crew in there that chat during our conversations, our broadcasts, and ask questions of our guests. We, of course, are talking in between episodes as well about Bitcoin and macroeconomics and much more. You can find that chat at t.me/SwanSignal. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with easy, recurring buys. Step one, we auto-fund USD from your bank account. Step two, we automatically purchase Bitcoin for you. And three, you can set up automatic withdrawals to your wallet. So that's the full process. We turn USD into Bitcoin and put it back into your wallet if you choose. Otherwise, it's stored safely with a licensed and regulated custodian. All at the lowest fees for recurring purchases in the industry, up to 80% lower than Coinbase, up to 57% lower than Cash App for automatic recurring purchases. We are forever Bitcoin only, laser focused on helping you stack sats. Follow us on Twitter at Swan Bitcoin and subscribe to this podcast if you're not already at swansignalpodcast.com. That's it for this week. Thanks for joining us.